Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studios here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, and this fellow here is Jeremy Goldcorn, the man behind Danway.com. How are you, sir?
Good evening, Kaiser.
Joining us today is Tanya Brannigan from The Guardian. Good to have you back on the show, Tanya.
It's good to be back.
We're also joined today by the writer Paul French, who has spent, over 20 years, is it, Paul? 20 years now living in China. Paul is, of course, the author most recently of Midnight in Peking, which we'll be discussing today at length. Welcome to Seneca, Paul.
Thank you. It's an honor.
Thanks so much for making the time. Before we launch into a discussion of Paul's book, which I should note is getting deservedly rave reviews, and before we get to the originally scheduled first topic for today's discussion, which incidentally is about the challenges of preservation and heritage in China's cities, we'd be remiss if we didn't chat at least a little bit about the big news of the day. At 10 a.m. this morning.
Today being the Ides of March.
The Ides of March, right. Yes.
And who says that the Chinese leaders don't have a sense of humor?
Anyway, so yeah, we're of course making these references to the fact of the very dramatic sacking of Bo Xilai, the controversial Chongqing Party secretary, a member of the powerful Politburo. He's been replaced by Zhang Dejiang is his name, who is a vice premier and also a Politburo member who served as party chief in Guangdong in the early 2000s and has been named now to replace him as Chongqing Party secretary. Tanya, now, without going too much into detail about the arcane and still largely opaque world of politics in Chongqing, can you give us a quick review of events just in the last couple of weeks?
Well, as so often in Chinese politics, it all starts with the allies, which is one of the interesting things. So his right-hand man, the guy who spearheaded this big strike black anti-crime drive in Chongqing, was suddenly moved sideways to another post, which was a little bit curious.
Yeah, Wang Lijun, right, of course.
And then all of a sudden, a few days later, we hear that there are large numbers of police surrounding the US embassy in Chengdu. Very, very near Chongqing, of course. And we discover later that Wang Lijun has spent over a day in there before he reemerges and is carted off, apparently, to Beijing, where he is now under investigation. Now, the obvious question is, why would he suddenly decide to head off to Chengdu? Well, originally we were told he was on vacation-style therapy.
Right.
One of the great euphemisms of our time.
I love it.
And then we found out that, in fact, he'd been in the consulate, as everybody suspected, and that he was now under investigation. And that was the point at which Bo Xilai's rise to the Politburo Standing Committee, which
was no longer a foregone conclusion.
I don't think it was ever a foregone conclusion, but it began to look increasingly unlikely.
Now it's vanishingly small. In fact, he will not.
I think it's vanished.
Does anyone know if he actually lost his Politburo seat?
No, they.
I don't think so. Not yet.
It hasn't said. There's no comment in the very terse one sentence.
Anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt your rollicking tale here. So now we've.
Well, so all eyes were on Bo at the NPC. I mean, I have to say, obviously, it's sort of in the nature of him that often all eyes have been on him because, by Chinese standards, he's an extremely colourful politician. Flamboyant is the word that endlessly crops up. And so he's known for his striking press conferences. And there was even more interest this time because he hadn't turned up at all the day before at the NPC. So there were all 24 other members of the Politburo were at one of the sessions and he was very noticeably absent. Then he gives this press conference in which he sort of mounts his fight back and says, it's an isolated case.
And my son doesn't own a Ferrari.
That's right. He was very
My son doesn't drive a Ferrari either, I believe he says.
And he got a scholarship. To study
indeed
at Cambridge.
So there was this fight back. He talked about critics pouring filth over him. It was quite gutsy stuff, as you would expect. But of course, that all started to look rather more fragile yesterday when Wen Jiabao made what was a very, very thinly veiled swipe at him.
What was the swipe exactly? I mean, just referring to the Cultural Revolution, that style of politics possibly rearing its ugly head again.
Indeed. Well, so there was a comment about the dangers of the an event like the Cultural Revolution reoccurring, which could be read either in the light of comments on political reform or as a reference to Bo, who, of course, has become known for what many people see as a sort of quasi-Maoist approach in Chongqing.
So, Paul, what do you make of this whole business? I mean, I take it you've been watching it pretty closely.
Well, from my point of view, I'm just enjoying the theatre of the whole thing. We don't get theatre very often. We don't get brawlers in Chinese politics like Bo very often, not since Zhu Rongji threw a few fits a while back. Before that, you've got to go back to, I mean, I think someone said that this was, you know, we haven't had anything like this since the Lin Biao plane crash, right? I also think, though, that with Bo and everything, it does reveal these other strands that go on in Chinese politics, which is the clan nature of a lot of politics, right? The center versus regions. I mean, it's all tied up in this story. Everything you could want to know about Chinese politics is in there somewhere, isn't it?
Yes, but we're not sure quite where. I mean, this is the trouble, that in a sense there's so much in there, it's very hard to disentangle. We're not entirely sure what Bo Xilai really stands for. I mean, he's famous for...
What's his sin here? I mean, is it right deviationism, left deviationism? What is it?
I think his sin is arguably attempting to go outside the party apparatus. I mean, somebody made the point, really, he's the first person since 78 who's been able to go outside that sort of existing structure and use his personality, use an attempt to appeal to the masses to really win support in a way that is threatening.
Because he comes over almost like one of those old-time Chicago mayors, right, who sort of goes around big cities, Dalian, Chongqing. These are the kind of places he likes.
That's right. I mean, Dalian, he did bring – I mean, Wang Lijun came from Dalian with him. Mm. He brought actually quite a number of people with him.
There's certainly a sense of him being somebody who has got things done. And if you look at, you know, people talk about sort of the Chongqing model, it's not entirely clear what it is. There's obviously the Red Songs campaign, there's the anti-crime campaign, but also there's been this very strong social justice component we've seen down there, a focus on welfare, a focus on tackling inequality. Did that actually come from him? Well, actually, one of the analysts I was talking to today said he was basically sent in because he was seen as somebody who could bang some heads together, overcome resistance and try and get this off the ground. So how much of this agenda was actually about him? Very hard to say.
Because when he came from Dalian, I mean, his reputation was as unusually friendly to Westerners, as a sort of cosmopolitan politician, I seem to remember.
Man you can do business with.
Whereas his image changed completely in Chongqing, and the Western press certainly, you know, the references to the Chongqing model tend to see it as a, you know, it's all about state-owned enterprise, and it's not necessarily very friendly to Western interests.
Without Bo Xilai to kick around anymore, I mean, I think from at least the perspective of theatricality, Chinese politics will certainly be much the poorer. Anyone care to speculate about his future, if any? I mean, could he rise again?
Well, some people are saying you couldn't rule it out, but I don't think we've necessarily seen the end of this round yet.
Yeah. One thing that slightly worried me was this Mr. Zhang, who's off to Chongqing. I don't know anything about him except that I read today, and I'd be slightly worried if I was in Chongqing. He has a degree in economics from Kim Il-sung University. I don't want to really diss the Faculty of Economics at Kim Il-sung University, but I'd be slightly nervous if he was coming to run my city of 30 million people.
The only other factoid that's been bandied about today is that he was actually responsible for going after the Southern Media Group in 2003 for their very aggressive reporting on the SARS cover-up that year. So that doesn't necessarily bode well for Chongqing either.
I think what may be more relevant, perhaps, than any Pyongyang-style experiments down in Chongqing, although never say never, is the fact that he's really seen as a sort of compromise candidate, somebody who can keep everybody in the party leadership happy. Nobody really has a problem with him. He's a princeling too. He gets on quite well with people. He's got links to Jiang Zemin. Mm-hmm. He's supposed to get on quite well with Hu Jintao. So it's sort of back to business as usual and rather boring stability from our point of view.
Meanwhile, Bo Xilai should probably not board any planes bound for
Mongolia.
Right. Anyway, let's resume our regularly scheduled program. We will certainly be revisiting this topic many times in the very near future. So preservation in China's cities. Let's first get an idea of where everyone situates his or herself on the spectrum between sort of the hardcore preservationists on the one hand, the past be damned, full steam ahead into the future type.
Before we do that, Kaiser, I think maybe we should also introduce Paul's interests in this area.
That's a good idea.
Because, I mean, aside from his book set in Beijing, the Midnight in Peking, I mean, Paul, you've been, I suppose, an amateur historian of China and Chinese cities really since you were here. You've been following the heritage preservation efforts in Shanghai and in Beijing and documenting some of the buildings that have been destroyed over the years. That's why we're talking about this topic, because Mr. French is something of an expert.
So why don't we start with Mr. French then in terms of, would you describe yourself as somebody who's preserve the buildings at all costs?
Yeah, I'm a fairly hardcore preservationist, I must admit. My issue, I do an annual list every year that I put on my blog of what Shanghai lost every year. And
that blog, by the way, just give everyone the URL.
It's www.chinarhyming.com. And I do a What We Lost list. And I think, for me anyway, there are issues, different issues in different cities and different issues around different architectural forms. I'm very worried about Shanghai because as well as losing Art Deco buildings, which are world-class Art Deco buildings and modernist buildings, we're also losing a lot of the traditional Shikumen and Lilong housing. Now, the thing about that is, okay, you could take the attitude that says, well, if we lose another Art Deco building, and every year we lose a couple more Art Deco buildings, everyone can just get on a plane and go to South Beach or somewhere and see Art Deco there. I mean, it does exist elsewhere. But if we lose all of the Shikumen and the Lilong housing, and at the moment it's like if it's a bank or a university building, perhaps,
it's going to get preserved.
Or a big colonial era house, it will get preserved. If it's just somewhere where ordinary people lived, it goes. The problem with that is it's almost, to me, akin to endangered species. It's like when the last Shikumen in Shanghai goes, that's the last Shikumen in the world because that architectural style is nowhere else. It goes the way of the Yangtze alligator or the dodo, right? And I think that, you know, that's particularly worrying. And we'll be left with this very unbalanced preservation where you won't be able to see where anyone lived unless they were very, very rich. But you will be able to see banks. You'll see lots of old banks.
Yeah, and I saw something that you wrote that future architects, or if I'm sorry, future archaeologists will believe that all we ever built were banks.
Yeah, we just built banks, and they don't knock down churches very often as well. So they'll think that China was an extremely Christian religious place.
Right, we're Republicans here, all banks and churches.
I mean, that's essentially the same problem in Beijing too. Mm. I mean, things that get preserved tend to be something that was something big or important or somebody famous lived there.
Unless you happen to have been named Liang Zicheng. Anyway, Jeremy, you haven't situated yourself on my spectrum, which I insist that you do. I mean, in the past, you and I have had discussions where you've actually kind of raged against the round eyes who insist that everything must be preserved, and you know, modernity, you know, screw it. Even though these places, these you know, so are, or you and I have both lived, are, you know, dangerous with, you know, the carbon monoxide poisoning and the faulty wiring. But, you know, you seem to have, on the other hand, I know that you were active in the effort to preserve the area around Hohhai, right?
Well, I don't know if I was active. I mean, I posted crap on the internet about it. But,
well, that's activist, right?
Okay.
Kono. What's his name? Joseph? Kony, that's it. Kony 2012. Right?
Kony.
Slacktivism.
Right, slacktivism. Yeah, I engaged in slacktivism around preservation in Beijing. I think I'm quite similar to Paul, actually. I mean, I do find it's nice to be a contrarian when there are kind of sentimental foreigners waxing on about hutongs. It can be annoying, especially for people who haven't actually lived in a hutong with Qing Dynasty plumbing. but, you know, I think that's really for effect. And what I do think is that it's a real shame that Beijing, like Shanghai, is losing everything that makes it different architecturally from anywhere else on Earth. And, you know, for me in Beijing, I think one of the biggest problems is really just is land rights and the fact that it's so difficult to pin down ownership of any piece of property. So nobody's going to risk the cost of living in an old house and fixing it up and gentrifying it like happens in other countries because they just don't think that it's worth risking money on that kind of thing. And until that changes,
what about you, Tanya? Where are you on this?
Well, I think what Jeremy's actually kind of pointing to in a way is that this is the wrong question. If you're asking old or new, you know, nobody's suggesting that people should all be condemned to share a public bathroom with sort of numerous other families. People do actually want plumbing and wiring that works and all that sort of thing. But on the other hand, they don't necessarily want to be cleared out to live at the edge of the city in a high rise where there's not much sense of community. And it's something that you can actually see happened in the UK in a lot of cities, including my own. What seemed like a great idea at the time actually turned out to be fraught with difficulty, and we lost a lot of really interesting architecture in the process. You don't have to kick everybody out of the hutongs and into some tower block on the sort of the sixth ring somewhere. There are other things you could do, and as usual, it's about money and about poorer people getting cleared out of the centres of cities.
And it's a central problem as well that, you know, I mean, there is lots of things that can be done with these properties. Not everything can be saved, but there is lots of things that can be done. But it does take money, and it takes a decision on who wants to live there and who doesn't, and who wants compensation and what that level of compensation is. And I think, you know, you find that lots of people want to live in very different places. I mean, some of the hutongs are in a very bad state. But it's also the case that the whole land system is a problem. I mean, you know, Shanghai, basically, the only way it gets money, it doesn't get it from income tax or anything. It gets it from stock market transactions, but the stock market's in the pits at the moment, so they're not getting much of that. And, you know, real estate sales, transactions, right? So there is a constant need to knock down and reuse land, not just of old buildings, but buildings that were built, you know, 20 years ago have to be knocked down, because that's the way that you make money. So that's why, arguably, you know, in the end, nothing might be saved, because, you know, the system to perpetuate itself has to keep reusing the land.
So, Paul, Shanghai is hosting the World Art Deco Conference in the year 2014, right? Mm. Is that a good thing or a bad thing from the point of view of preservationists?
Well, I hope it is. I mean, I'm fairly... I think that sometimes you do have to sort of shame people into doing a good thing. And it might be the case that... I don't think that the Shanghai authorities want everyone to come from around the world to the Art Deco Congress, the World Art Deco Congress in 2014, and look at rubble. Right. I mean, I think they actually the problem that I have, of course, is that 2015 might be the year that we lose everything Art Deco in China.
OK, but, we're done with that now.
But I think that we might get to save something. At the moment, though, you know, the other problem we have, as ever in China, is a regulation and enforcement thing. So, of course, you know, people could wander in here and say, well, you know, there's over 2,000 buildings in Shanghai that have preservation orders on them. And, you know, these are protected. But I think there's two problems with that. One is, they're protected until they're not protected, and then they go. And on my website, you can see lots of examples of preserved buildings that have disappeared at 3 o'clock in the morning when a bulldozer goes in. And the other thing is, China's laws are not very good at preserving interiors. Right? So you do get the facade. If you the Bund is the great example of this. Mm-hmm. You'll get the facades somewhere like number 3, the Bund. The facade is great. The interior has been completely ripped out and looks like some sort of trashy London or New York 1980s.
Prague or Leningrad had the same problems. Right?
Yeah, so there's no preservation of the insides.
I think also, I mean, you touched on it, but the sort of layering of the past in Chinese cities is in some ways almost the worst crisis. And, you know, Beijing, old school kind of boxy apartment buildings, which are part of the history of the city, mm-hmm. are also going now, and they're not ever going to be protected by any kind of legal act, because they're just too new.
Well.
But it's such a shame that, you know,
Hong Kong is now
time,
doing some nice preservations of some of those great 1960s urban housing
kind of
development
kind of
round houses that you get.
Yeah,
those have been preserved, and those can be tarted up and made nice, and are part of the cityscape. They've become part of the cityscape.
Well, I'm not sure about Beijing. I mean, in this case, with anything built basically between 1970 and 1988 is probably not worth preserving.
Yeah.
I
mean,
this is also a lifestyle thing, you know. As China does get richer, as urban dwellers do get richer, they're going to look at their cities and wonder what happened. I mean, Singapore was a great example of that. That it was sort of 5 minutes before they were going to knock down the last row of shop houses in Singapore, that Singapore fortunately reached a level where people suddenly cared, and, you know, little businesses wanted to go in and turn them round and everything.
Sort of,
you know,
just clicked past the per capita GDP requirements.
Yeah, then all of a sudden you care about this stuff more.
I think the other thing that's interesting is that quite often if you get a bar moving in somewhere or a club, there's this sense that that's inappropriate. People suddenly start caring, actually, and people will try and do something about it. And yet when it's just sort of day-to-day neglect or things falling under the bulldozer even, it's as if people almost just don't notice it now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Although I think Shanghai has been very good, and a lot of buildings have been saved by becoming upscale restaurants and upscale sort of bars and things. You know, Beijing doesn't seem to have done that quite so well for, I don't know why, it doesn't seem to have been so successful here, but particularly
upscale
a lot of
restaurants generally, I think, well, Beijing struggles. I mean, certainly Western type restaurants, which are a lot of those buildings in Shanghai are.
But in Shanghai, I mean, again, you know, there is a, you know, a lot of those restaurants are Chinese. They're not for Western clientele mostly. So, you know, they're Shanghainese themselves do enjoy going to those mansions and villas and going to those Bund type places. Mm-hmm. They seem to be into it. But that, like, you know, the sort of the American legation thing here and everything, that development, none of that seems to have done quite so well for some reason in Beijing.
I've always had the sense that, I mean, is it just the grass being greener on the other side? Or, I mean, my sense is that Shanghai just has done a consistently better job in preserving old heritage sites than Beijing has. I mean, Beijing has just done everything that it's touched, and when it's tried to do anything by way of preservation, I mean, there's like what I call the Chen minification of things. It's just god-awful. I mean,
Shanghai's done some very silly ones. I mean, one that you come across quite a lot when you go around China is, of course, the idea that we want to preserve some buildings. There's a new development in Shanghai called Sunan Mansions on the old Rue Massenet on Sunan. And it was some beautiful mansions. But they decided that they were too close together and they wanted to sort of put restaurants in them. So they basically sort of lifted them up, gutted them, put in new foundations. I mean, basically, there's about 5% of the original building left and created gaps between them so that people could walk where there weren't gaps before. And Shanghai is extremely proud of that development in the way that it's extremely proud of Shin Tiandi as well, which has sort of then been exported around the country. Everyone wants a Shin Tiandi or three at the moment. That sort of, you know, new old type concept, which they do with traditional Chinese architecture. I'm sure you've all been to places where there's the old Chinese walking street and things like that, you know, where something Chengdu's perfectly... Chengdu's got one. I mean, you know, you come across them everywhere. But at least things do get saved. There are cities where I think they've become extremely characterless from when I first knew them. And I mean, Wuhan is very much like that. The whole Bund has been taken down and destroyed. Nanjing, I think, is very quickly going that way.
We could probably, run through a long litany of bad examples. What about the good ones? Has anyone done it? Are there any outstanding cities in China that have done an admirable job of...
Well, I'd argue one that's done quite well is Qingdao. Mm-hmm. I think Qingdao's done quite well for one simple reason, which was it's on the coast. So when they built the new bit of the city, they just built it further along the coast, which meant that they didn't have to go in and tear down a lot of the original German architecture and so on. So
what
I
about
think
Dalian?
They did quite well.
How's Dalian faring, do you think?
Dalian, well, the old Russian street there and everything has all gone a bit kitsch. There's an old Russian church that's a Kentucky Fried Chicken. It's the only time I've ever been grateful for Kentucky Fried Chicken keeping the onion dome thing going. They've done quite well. I mean, there are smaller places, Morganshan, the old hill resort, of course, has been looked after quite well. Suzhou has been kind of reasonably well restored in various places. I mean, I heard you guys talking about Westlake in Hangzhou the other week. I think the lake itself, but there's some pretty... there's another Shin Tiandi thing that's been slapped in there, which is completely inappropriate for Hangzhou.
And what about China compared to its other East Asian neighbors, Korea, Japan?
Well, I think, again, it's when you hit a certain level of... of wealth. I mean, nobody cared about anything in Seoul. And I mean, if you've been to Seoul, you'll know it's just spreading.
Right. Soulless, yeah.
But there's now this kind of move for the traditional, what they call accordion-style housing. That's been there. I mean, I think Singapore is an example where now in Singapore, the preservation movement is very big and also knocking down classic sort of modern 1950s buildings that are quite gorgeous as well and not being knocked down. Hong Kong has turned the corner after destroying things like Wedding Street. And a lot of places like that. It looks now, when it was young people in Hong Kong who got down there to save the clock tower at the ferry pier and everything. Mm-hmm. And I like them there. They're also running great campaigns to save, not to take this too far off, to save the banyan trees. Because, you know, trees are heritage as well, right? You know, knocking down trees is a bit of a crime. So that Hong Kong seems to have turned the corner, I think. Macau was doing okay, but then, you know, the casinos came in. But the center of Macau... You know, again, like Westlake, I think, is a UNESCO site. So it's always, if you get the UNESCO thing, again, if you destroy a UNESCO site, that's a big loss of face, isn't it, to destroy a UNESCO site?
So if any of our listeners are interested in getting involved in this, what organizations in China are doing the really good work?
Beijing has an organization called Beijing Cultural Heritage Preservation Society, I think, and they're online, and they are worth joining.
We'll dig up a link to them and put it on the page.
Yeah, I mean, in Shanghai, you know, there's by sort of encouraging people to go on walking tours and things like that, the Royal Asiatic Society, which has been refounded there, is doing quite well. Tongji University's architecture department is great. I mean, there's a professor there who must be about 80 now, but he's still teaching. And when they tried to knock down the beautiful old sheds, the headquarters of the rowing club on Suzhou Creek, I mean, they did that at 3 o'clock in the morning, and he literally was standing there with a bulldozer. Again, when they knocked down parts of what is supposed to be the completely preserved old Jewish ghetto. But, you know, the Jewish ghetto keeps losing buildings every year. And when they took down the White Star Inn, where... Right up until they knocked it down, you could still see the Yiddish lettering in the front and things like that. He went and tried to do that. They've tried to at least catalogue what's there and say, you know, this is the legacy that we have and we should preserve. And that's about the best you can do. But, you know, Chinese politics, when a guy wants the land, he wants the land, the developer goes in, it's the midnight demolition, and that's the end of it.
Well, great. Let's see.
It's not great, really.
It's great that there are at least these organizations, and I'm glad that we've helped our listeners to identify some of them if they do want to pitch in. Let's shift discussion now to Paul, to your recent book, which is going to be released in the U.S. this month, right? Or no, next month.
April,
yeah. That's right, through Penguins Viking Press. It's already been available for over a year now, and I only managed to read it just this last weekend. It was very widely read and very well received by China watchers the world over. I have yet to read a review that was less than glowing, actually. You're doing well there. And were I to chime in with a review of my own, it would be no less. So the book centers, of course, on an investigation of the savage murder of a 19-year-old English woman named Pamela Werner in January of 1937. Beijing, which was then Beiping, I guess, right? Mm-hmm. It's its status as a Jing, a capital.
You try selling a book called Midnight in Beiping. Beiping,
yeah, right. It was something of a backwater at that point, right, as you described.
Well, the capital had moved to Nanjing in 1927. The money was in Tianjin and Shanghai, and it was surrounded by the Japanese. It was a pretty tough gig.
Yeah.
It was Beijing at that time.
Yeah. So, yeah, we were all sort of here in Beijing, not me personally, but was watching as Japanese troops, having already seized Manchuria in 1932, were, you know, staging all sorts of incidents, and the Marco Polo Bridge incident was just a few months off, mm-hmm. right. So you've let's all three play interviewer now. Tanya, Jeremy, and I have all read the book and really enjoyed it, so I'm sure we've got a ton of questions that we'd like to ask Paul. Anyone want to go first? Actually, let me get you with one that'll start you off. You've talked about how you got originally interested in how you first heard of the murder of Pamela Werner. You were reading Red Star Over China, or no, a biography.
Reading a very dry biography of Edgar Snow, which was tough because it was a hard book to read, and I don't like Edgar Snow. I think he was a bit of a dupe, so I can't be bothered with him.
Sure.
But there was one little footnote. There was a little footnote that said that they lived on the same hutong called Armour Factory Alley, which is still there. Near the Fox Tower, the Dongbian Mansion, and it was on the 7th of January, 1937, then their neighbours, a 19-year-old girl called Pamela Werner, whose father had been a former British consul general in China and went back to the 19th century in China, she was found murdered and her body was horribly mutilated by the Fox Tower, and also that it was investigated by the head of the Chinese Detective Bureau, a man called Colonel Han, but that they brought in a Scotland Yard detective who was running the British police in Tianjin. DCI Dick Dennis. I mean, you couldn't make that up, could you?
No.
And
that's why you need to make a movie of this. I mean,
They worked together to try and solve the crime with the interference of the British Embassy.
Who would have thought
the British Embassy was interfering?
It's perfect. So. You got a Chinese detective, an English detective.
Yeah. Except the only problem is that, of course, you know, the end of that story should be China and Britain coming together can overcome any problem and solve any problem. The problem was they didn't manage to solve the murder.
Because the real protagonist is the father, because E.C.T. Werner really is the Werner is the true protagonist of the story, right?
Well, if they made a film, Paul French could be the protagonist too, right?
Yeah, well, you think it'd be like that Julia and Julia film about the cook woman? Well, half of it about me in my flat in Shanghai.
You basically claim in the book that you solved the murder.
I don't think that's what Paul's saying.
What happened was that I thought it was going to be a book about a murder that was never solved, but at a really interesting time, right on that point when China was going from civilization to barbarism as the Japanese were about to invade. And that it would be a book that showed a lot of scandal and white mischief in the foreign community and this interesting case. And that I just wouldn't be able to solve it, but there were enough smells and bells and whistles and some good characters that it would make an interesting book. And I was in the National Archive in London, the UK National Archive, looking at all this uncatalogued material there from Beijing, British Embassy Beijing. And I just came across this 150-page document, which was a private investigation. When the Japanese invaded in July 1937, the official investigation had to end. The father carried on using his own money and his own time and becoming bankrupt, losing his health and everything, trying to solve the murder. And then he wrote it up and sent it to London. Because of the war, it didn't get to London until 1943. London, to be fair, had other things to worry about in 1943. It never got read. And when I went back and cross-referenced everything with the police notes, the autopsy, the newspapers at the time, and I found about six or seven people who, in their 80s and 90s, who had known Pamela at school, so I could get the gossip that was going around at that time as well. I feel that he solved it. So technically, I think I found the document that he solved it. But of course, you know, in marketing terms, I solved a 76-year-old murder and I'm sticking to that.
Right. Hence your part in the film.
You got very close to E.C.T. Warner during the course of writing this book. You must feel like you know him pretty well. How would you describe this man? I mean, he's quite an eccentric character, isn't he?
He was an intense sinologist. He had been in Peking since the 1880s. He spoke eight Chinese. There was no Putonghua at the time, so he spoke eight Chinese dialects. This made him amazing to Chinese people as well. He was a leading sinologist. And when he finished his somewhat troubled career, but when he finished his career as the consul general of Fuzhou then, he didn't go home and live in Bournemouth or Brighton, as you're supposed to do if you're a British Empire official. He stayed in Peking and became this very noted sinologist, doing incredible work that we still read. His Myths and Magic of China is still on set, a set text on that subject. But, you know, he was English. He was cold. He was unemotional. He did not necessarily shower love upon his daughter in the way that people might do now. And I thought, well, that's okay. I can write about that because, you know, I had an English father who was cold and unemotional and all the rest of it. So I know that kind of father. But what happened was when I found this other story of him, you know, it showed that he really put his heart and soul into trying to solve the murder. And I thought at that point, I warmed to him. So hopefully when you read the book, you move from thinking of him as this cold, unemotional English guy, moving through to someone who you have to judge by his deeds rather than his words, who was really devoted to his daughter.
That's very clear.
Well, I guess like Jeremy, you know, my question is, who do you see playing him? Because the thing when you read the book is it's a real page turner. I stayed up extraordinarily late to finish it off, having thought I'd just read the first chapter. But the other thing I thought was...
It's Jeremy Irons, right? I mean,
you think so? Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
But I think the other thing that struck me about the book was that, without wishing to drop a spoiler into this conversation, it seems as if it's surrounded by these... It's a case that's surrounded by these quite orientalist conceptions that here's this innocent young British girl murdered in this strange, sinister, slightly alien place. And yet what comes out of it is much more about the expatriate life than it is really about the Chinese. And I wondered how much you were thinking about that, how much that was the purpose of the book.
Being an
expatriate, in a sense, when
yourself,
you sat down to write it.
Well, I was fascinated by two things. One was, of course, the white mischief and the scandals within the community. But, you know, I've always written about Shanghai before. And in a sense, Shanghai in the 1930s is wide open, right? Everyone knows what's going on. Everyone knows where the badlands are. Everyone knows what's happening. Very little work has been done on that side of Peking life, because Peking has this massive long narrative compared to Shanghai. So there's so much to write about. So although people know the Legation Quarter area in the city a little bit, the little Badlands area that they had, which was where, you know, the Chinese had their own place, the Bada Hutong and everything over there. But this was really for the Europeans. It was run by white Russians mostly. Brothels, bars, opium dens, heroin being sold on the street, pornography being sold. Yeah. But by foreigners to foreigners, basically. Right,
Sanlitor.
And it was this area called the Badlands. And that's kind of been lost a little bit from the narrative of Peking, I felt. And so I was fascinated. And it's very hard to grab back because, of course, you know, all the memoirs we have are by diplomats or missionaries or diplomats.
What strikes me is that it's the willful ignorance of the existence of the Badlands almost that stymies the investigation in a lot of ways.
Yeah, because no one wants to admit it's there, right? We don't want to admit it. We don't want to lose it. It's, you know, this white underclass, what the Americans used to call the ne'er-do-wells of China, the China drifters, the driftwood.
There's some really great characters that you introduced through the course of this. I mean, the people who were initially accused, you know, these old ex-soldiers. There's a Filipino guy who had joined the U.S. Marines in Tianjin. And, I mean, these guys are what a crazy cast. I mean, this would be a very fun movie to cast.
These people were all out there. And of course, the fascinating thing for me as well was, you know, the British particularly would have loved to have thought, here's the Legation Quarter with our clubs and our nice tea dances and all the rest of it. And there's the Badlands where all those bad people go. Because what the investigation revealed was that those two worlds intersected and crossed over far more than anyone felt very comfortable with.
Spoiler alert. But you really did confirm me in my hatred for I have to say.
Well, yes, there is a character in the book who doesn't come out of it very well, who was And actually, when with Penguin, the editors just sat there, rolled their eyes and said, so you want us to publish a book where perhaps the bad guy turns out to be... I mean, you know, this is the ultimate villain to the British, right?
Hey, and them's the facts. Now, I guess the book, I mean, no, I'm sorry. The question that really burned, I mean, I want to play Colonel Han, right? Mm. I mean, I think I'll cut my hair to play that. But where do you come down on him in the end? I mean, he is just a really, he's an intriguing character to me in this whole thing.
The thing about doing nonfiction, although it's literary nonfiction, is you can't really make anything up, right? So, you know, I think he was basically a good copper. But I think he also did take money from certain Badlands establishments because that was his patch. I don't think he sought to misdirect the investigation or scupper the investigation. But by having, you know, that old thing of by having started off being corrupt, it ends up moving up the tree and ends up meaning that you can't do your job properly.
I mean, I felt like maybe I read this wrong, but I think he went to... Didn't he go there with... one point?
No, they think that there was a brothel and that there was a next door to it. He was taking money from, it would seem, from both of these places. So he kind of suggested they shouldn't go back there, but he really had no reason to suspect but the problem is, you know, when you're doing the real life thing, of course it would be lovely to have a clean policeman in there. I don't think it would have been possible to really find one in real life. I mean, you know, but also on the British side, I mean, the guys made very fundamental errors in not chasing up basic bits of, basic bits of evidence, in checking things out, in not resisting the powers that be who sort of told them not to talk to certain people and things
right,
like that.
Right, I mean, Dick Dennis is guilty of this too, right?
He's guilty of it as well, yeah.
Well, what a fascinating book. You guys have, I'm sure, are brimming with questions about, you know, little subtleties of plot. Jeremy, maybe it's been too long since...
I'm trying very hard not to issue any more spoilers because I think a really key part of the book is that you just want to keep reading. I mean, it's a heartbreaking book in many ways, but it's actually something where you really want to know what's going to happen next. And Kaiser, I hope you haven't ruined it for everybody.
For me, being in Beijing, though, the interesting thing is that, you know, it's really interesting to see, you know, it's like, coming from Shanghai, where the 1930s just looms so large over us, and we all know every building, and it's impossible not to have read Empire of the Sun, and it's impossible not to have read all these books. It's impossible to walk past the Peace Hotel, the Cafe Hotel, as was, and not know that it was Sir Victor Sassoon's and the dancing and Emily Hahn and her pet gibbon and all the rest of it went there. You know, this is Shanghai history. You know, here, because the narrative arc is so long with the history, you know, and the films that people know are, you know, it's all about the Temple of Heaven and the Forbidden City and the Summer Palace. You know, maybe people know the Boxer Rebellion and all of these sort of things.
But it's also about its relationship with the outside world, isn't it? That Shanghai is much more a city that is about its relationship with everywhere else and about the people who come in and out.
Yeah.
In a way that Beijing hasn't been.
I think the foreign community here was ever a footnote, right?
Yeah, it was always a footnote, but it was always quite a Victorian sort of community in the sense that it tended to be people who felt they were very proper. It was always quite small. It was quite incestuous. But as we know, you know, with Victorians, you know, when they get dirty, they get really dirty, right? You know, as the rest of us just sort of bubble along on the surface thinking we're dirty. But the Victorians really knew how to do it. So that was Shanghai, of course, has that element to it because it's a port city, right? And there's something special about port cities everywhere in the world. And even today, because it's a working port, Shanghai has that little buzz that I think port cities have just because of the transitory nature of so many people.
Also, I mean, Beijing, there's something quite peculiar about it. I mean, to go back to our first topic of preservation, the Legation Quarter area, which has some of the most interesting foreign-styled architecture in northern China, is a total dead zone. There are a few restaurants that are in the area. None of them have become very popular. Most of the buildings are inaccessible because they're controlled, I think, by the police or one arm of the police. And I almost get the sense that it's in Beijing, it's embarrassing to really talk about this colonial period architecture, whereas Shanghai does, in fact, celebrate it. I mean, it might occasionally fine a pizza restaurant for referring to the French concession, but I mean, the Shanghai city government even will celebrate the foreign architectural heritage. Beijing, not at all.
And it amazes me that in the heart of this, the capital of China, this incredible city, it was called Mongolian city, Chinese city, but, you know, in the heart of it is this sort of square mile or so of just incredible Western architecture, which, and you know, and it's all being used. People are living in it. I take walking tours through there every so often, and we have to walk quite briskly through that part because the police don't like people lingering around. The French, the former French embassy is quite important in the story as one of the last places Pamela was seen alive. And you walk past there, and of course you can't stop because that's where Prince Sihanouk now lives and everything, right? So he's got this guard. And, you know, you walk past there with, I walked past there the other night with 30 members of book Shunyi book clubs, you know, women who'd come into town, and we have to sort of keep moving. It's the only part of Beijing where they switch the traffic lights off early at night. But also things like the St. Michael's Church is one of the most gorgeous examples of a double-spired French church in Asia, if not the world. And as far as I know, that church is completely locked up, completely sealed down. You can't get in there at all.
It's amazing how little attention there is paid to the sort of colonial period architecture. I mean, I don't know how many people I have brought to the Beitang Cathedral who have just had no idea that this thing existed or a Xishi Ku. People, have you been there?
Yeah, I used to work right next to it. Actually,
it's really. I mean, that's an amazing thing. I mean, it was built.
But I'm also amazed that, you know, I take people down to look at the Fox Tower, right, where I think you got married.
I did.
Right?
I got married there.
And yeah, this is the only watchtower left in Beijing. It was built roughly at the same time. It's an incredible structure, and it was built roughly at the same time that the first production of Hamlet occurred in London, right? And it's amazing. Like me, there's the Redgate Art Gallery in there and so on. But you go there on a Saturday lunchtime and you get it to yourself. There's nobody there.
That's right.
Now, and I find that's part of this whole preservation and heritage thing, which is, you know, you try and take the family to see a stately home in England, right? Particularly now we've had bloody Downton Abbey on the television and everything. Or you go and see an old southern mansion down in Georgia or something, right? There will be hundreds of people there flocking around, wanting to see it, wanting to have tea and cakes when they go there and everything. And here, because it's not, they don't take the tour groups there very much, there's this gorgeous 16th century watchtower there. The only one left, the only bit of the wall that's left where you can see the width of the wall as well as the height of the wall.
Right, and with a lot of the original masonry there.
And it's pretty much deserted all the time.
Yeah.
And what does it take to... What does it take to get people interested then?
I don't really understand, except I think that it is about like an income level, and you get to a certain income level. I think China as well, on a broader level, is of course an economic superpower, but it's a long way yet off being a leisure superpower. I think people still don't quite know what to do with their time beyond, you know, going shopping, which is fine because that's kept me in my day job for quite a few years of writing about consumers and everything. But people still don't quite know what to do with their time, do they?
I think there's also a problem about the way history is viewed and used and abused, and history education. History is not something that a high school student is likely to get particularly interested in China compared to Europe, because the way it's taught is extremely boring. And, you know, I think everybody knows that what you read in the textbooks is kind of fake in some way or another. It perhaps doesn't make for a society where people will... It doesn't naturally lead to an interest in such things.
And, of course, this paranoia goes on. This is a story that your listeners will like, which is when we did the feature on this for That Shanghai, you know, the listings magazine that they have there, the English language listings magazine, we wrote it up. And, of course, it then has to go before the censor. And we managed to persuade the censor that, we could talk about the story and the murder, but, of course, we couldn't give away the end of it. And the guy was sussed enough to understand that. But me and the editor of the magazine had to go down to his office and both sign a form that indemnified him that if he allowed this article to be run, the people then wouldn't read the book and find out on the last page that a member of the Chinese Communist Party had murdered Pamela Werner.
That is funny. And my listeners will appreciate that. Hey, listen, so we do this thing at the end of every show where each of us gives a recommendation of something that they've read or seen, a documentary or a television show or what have you. And so while you're maybe thinking about what you have to recommend this week, I want to make a couple of quick announcements. One is that we now have a Twitter feed, Seneca Podcast. It's at Seneca Podcast, as well as a Facebook page, which is also just simply Seneca. You can go online and like those things or follow us on Twitter. And why don't we start with Jeremy with recommendations?
Sure. First of all, I have a little addition to one of my previous recommendations about the azure-winged magpie, which you can see in Rutan Park, because I've spotted a tree on the northeast corner, more or less, of Rutan Park, where there's this huge flock of azure-winged magpies, and I'm very concerned that our listeners who live in Beijing should see this pretty bird. But the real recommendation is a new website or blog, blockedonweibo.tumblr.com. It's started by a guy named Jason Q Ng, I think, and he's basically been running code and analyzing words that are blocked on Weibo and trying to figure out why they're blocked and writing each word up. And it's
I find it really puzzling. I mean, I can't make heads or tails of why half of these words are blocked.
Yes, I think that clearly the censors are completely off their heads, but
this is no news. Paul, do you have something you'd like to recommend?
I do. I have a couple of things, actually. One is anyone who's interested in looking at the destruction of just ordinary housing and ordinary communities in Shanghai, particularly north of Suzhou Creek in the old Hongkou and Yangpu areas, should check out the work of a very talented Singaporean Chinese photographer based in Shanghai called Su An Tay.
And how do you spell that?
T-A-Y.
Okay.
And she has a blog. I'm not exactly sure the URL, but just Google or Baidu Shanghai street stories. And what she does is she goes out and she really gets into these old lanes and lilongs. She's a little Chinese girl, so she's able to get places that people like 6'5" Englishmen can't get. And she takes all these wonderful stories. She writes it up. She, of course, speaks Chinese. She interviews people. And it's a wonderful record of what's being lost and what people think about it.
Shanghai street stories. I have seen that. It is indeed excellent. And Tanya... Oh, you had a couple of things.
Well, I had one other thing. I just saw it recently. And I always know, you know, I know Jeremy goes out to the war, and but my China experience has been completely urban, my whole China experience. You know, I don't think I've ever gone to a city with less than 6 million people in it. You know, I mean, that's small town China for me. And I never go to the countryside. And I was just in the Adelaide Documentary Film Festival, and I saw a Beijing-based guy called Wei Jun Chen, who has done this incredible documentary called The Law of the Dragon. And he goes up into I think it's Hunan, right out somewhere where there's like 3 or 4 families live. And he follows a judge who walks around mediating disputes. One is where someone's committed suicide and they accuse the school of causing it. Another one is, you know, two families who've gone to war over a water pipe or something. Another one is a divorce where someone wants to get divorced. All of them, of course, as he investigates, you know, all sorts of stuff comes out. It looks very clear at the start in that Chinese way. It all gets very messy. And he goes around and he just sits down with them and mediates and adjudicates. And I can't imagine how you would go and see that for yourself. It's the most wonderful, compelling documentary I've seen for a long time.
Oh, that sounds fabulous. The documentary...
The Law of the Dragon. And the director is Wei Jun Chen, who is funded by the BBC and did that great documentary, The Biggest Chinese Restaurant in the World. Have you ever seen that one where they all roller skate round? It's this giant restaurant up in Tianjin somewhere that he did.
Wow, that sounds really great. I'm definitely going to check that out. Thank you. Tani, what you got for us this week?
Well, I would second the vote for the azure-winged magpies. One of my highlights of my career was managing to get them into a totally unrelated Guardian intro at one point.
I didn't know that. We'll have to provide a link for that story.
Absolutely. Please do. Make sure to talk to her.
But the other thing is a documentary that's actually on YouTube, which is the training films that were used for Hungarian secret agents. And is really quite fantastic viewing.
Who's we here?
No, the training used for Hungarian.
The actual training films that
Hungarian secret services
that
own
they
training
used
films.
In house.
The NKVD.
And somebody has cut them together into a very interesting documentary, which I thoroughly recommend. And I will make sure you get the link.
Absolutely, thank you very much. I'm going to really cheat this week, and I'm holding in my hands The Old Shanghai, A to Z, by none other than the man across from me, Paul French, which was just be gifted to me. It looks absolutely terrific. I'm really looking forward to talking into this. It's literally A to Z, a city that I know not nearly enough about, and I'm really eager to learn more of. When did you publish this? Just a couple of years ago, right?
It was a couple of years ago, but it's just every street with the old road name, the new name. And so anyone who's going there who wants to try and situate themselves in Shanghai when it was the concessions... Hopefully this might help them. And it reveals, you know, there are so many buildings, despite we've been saying everything's destroyed, there are so many buildings left and people are always asking, what was that? Who lived there? You know.
No, I mean, now having become a fan of your prose, I'm sure I'm going to really enjoy this. Anyway, thanks, folks. Make sure to go on our Facebook page and like us. Tell us also while you're there what you'd like to hear about, some of the guests you'd like us to have on or have back. Tell us what you think. And thank you very much. We'll see you next week on the Seneca Podcast. Bye-bye.